Hello, and welcome to Social Justice Matters, a podcast from Social Justice Ireland. I'm Eamon Murphy, Economic and Social Analyst with SGI. Our Social Justice Matters podcast comes in a few different formats. We'll be uploading some of our most important and relevant presentations from past SGI events as part of our seminar series, and our 10-minute lessons are a series of short introductory tutorials about important policy areas. This episode is the second in our interview series, and it comes from our 32nd annual Social Policy Conference, which took place 2 weeks ago at Croke Park. In it, Mick Clifford of the Irish Examiner interviews Roddy Doyle. Roddy has produced some of the greatest works of Irish fiction of the last three decades, including the Barrytown trilogy, The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, and Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha, for which he won the Booker Prize in 1993. In the interview, Roddy discusses Fighting Words, the organisation he created to help children and young people discover and harness the power of their own imaginations and creative writing skills. He also gives his opinions on education policy, including his desire that Leaving Cert be scrapped and something else be built from scratch in its place, and many other areas. While you're here, why not check out our last podcast episode 2? It comes from the same conference, and it's part of our seminar series. In it, our research and policy officer, Colette Bennett, reviews Rebuilding Ireland, the government's housing strategy. The presentation pretty much tears to shreds, pillar by pillar, any notion that the government's strategy is working, and comes complete with all the info and evidence to prove it. For now, enjoy Roddy Doyle.
And now we move on to our next guest. I could give you a long resume for Roddy Doyle, but I think the vast majority of you will know him as one of our most successful and best writers over perhaps the last 30 years. Roddy is here today in particular... Roddy is here today in particular to talk about Fighting Words. And Fighting Words is a creative writing centre he co-founded in Dublin in 2009 to help students of all ages to develop their writing skills and to explore their love of writing. It provides storytelling workshops for primary school groups, creative writing workshops for secondary students, summer camps as well, and for groups of adults with special needs. All of the tutoring is free. And Fighting Words workshops are created and run by volunteers, writing tutors who include novelists, screenwriters, journalists, poets, aspiring writers, student teachers from DCU and many of the Dublin Colleges of Education, along with retired teachers and people who are just interested to get involved. Roddy, you're very welcome to the conference.
Thank you.
Could I start by asking you, what prompted you to set up Fighting Words?
Well, I suppose I was a teacher for 14 years, and it's a bit of a congenital disorder, I think. It's not... So I retired from teaching, or I left teaching in 1993, but I don't think you can just go take a shower and that's that then. So I've always been a bit of a teacher. The Red Biro was never far from my my hand. But I was in San Francisco, I don't know how long ago, and a friend of mine, Dave Eggers, a writer, had set up an organization for writing for children called 826 Valencia, which is the address on Valencia Street in San Francisco. And he asked me to go down and have a look at it. And I did, because he was a friend of mine. I hadn't given it much thought. And went in, and there was something happening behind a black curtain. I couldn't quite see what was going on, but I found the way in and just sat and watched this magical experience, these small children on beanbags in front of a screen, and they were collectively writing a story. And there was a typist behind them typing the words onto the big screen. And an artist, it was a woman, beside them drawing a character from the story they were taking as they were writing the story. And it was really, really beautiful. It was great fun, but it was really, really great. And I thought it was a wonderful way to start kind of the sometimes daunting task of filling a page that you get and work together with your friends. And I got to know a little bit more about 826 Valencia, and I was curious about what they did with older children, secondary school kids. And I went back, I was in San Francisco again about a year later, and I stayed a few days longer than I had planned on doing, and I went out with them to see what they were doing in high schools. And it was equally impressive, very, very different, but equally impressive. And it began to fester away in my head. I thought, you know, this would really work in Ireland. It would really work in Ireland. And in my last years as a teacher, I mean, I had four novels published by the time I gave up teaching, and I was teaching English, and I could not, given the curriculum, I could not encourage children and teenagers to write fiction, because if they were doing honours English, it wasn't there. It wasn't an option. And the pressure always was, do the essay because it's easier to mark. That kind of corruption, frankly. So you can't, you know, even if you love the job of teaching, which I did, when it comes up to exam time, you can't escape the fact that you're actually stoking a machine, yeah. You know? And I thought Fighting Words, and my co-founder, Sean Love, who had been CEO of Amnesty, we thought that this was a way of nibbling away at, well, frankly, the Leaving Cert, really, and the structures that are put in place there, that we would, you know, considering we're a country that prides ourselves in its creativity, and that we, you know, you're dead a half hour and there'll be a T-shirt and tea towels. And, you know, we name planes and we name boats and, you know, probably tanks.
Bridges.
I don't know, bridges. Oh, yeah. I have the one I want earmarked. But, you know, we love the association, really, with writing. And yet the education system almost actively discourages it. And this seems perverse. So we got up and running more than 10 years ago now, January 2009. And our first branch is just across the way on Russell Street, down near the corner with North Circular Road. We deliberately located there in the north inner city. And a lot of our clients, the children and teenagers who come to us, a good deal of them walk there. And word of mouth spread then really quickly, and we noticed after the first year, when we put up our program for the following year, the timetable for the following year, it was full in an hour. And we now have centres in, I think by the end of this year or maybe early next year, 14 different locations on the island. East Belfast, I won't go through them all, but the ones that spring to mind immediately, East Belfast, Galway, Mayo, Wexford, Listowel, Clare is coming. The Midlands, I can't remember exactly. That's one of, you know, we were doing good around the coasts, but and working with libraries. The libraries are brilliant. The librarians actually want this sort of activity in the libraries. And I was down at Wexford Library, and it seems to me that they actively encourage noise, which struck me as being wonderful. You know? And now we're also involved in teacher training increasingly. Later in the week, I'm going to meet a group of teachers who are doing a version of the same course that we're doing with teenagers, because they really want to bring it into the classroom and use it. And the week after, I'm going into Docus. There's a group we're working with, women prisoners. We work in Oberstown very, very successfully. We're about in there about 6 years now, I think, and we've done a course in Mountjoy. I didn't do that particular one, but I was in Wheatfield, and Wheatfield was the most extraordinary experience.
Why?
Group of kids. I call them kids. You know, at a stage of my life, anybody under the age of 57 is a kid. I exaggerate slightly. You're looking well. But group of kids who shouldn't have been in there in the first place, but they were. And you would see, you'd see them coming at you and you think, oh, Christ. And they were very lively, very, you know, the shoulders were on the go. And we decided that the best thing we could do with them was a screenplay. Not a short story, but a script, a screenplay. And they loved the idea. And they got going on it. So again, we were using a big screen. And it was absolutely brilliant. And one of the lads who started off, you know, he said, and it's all in the present tense as well, which they love, you know. We see this, we see that. And he said, we see two lads in a car. I said, they own it. And he knew he was being entertaining. He knew he was being funny. He knew he was leading us into a great story. I don't know about his education. I don't know where he is, what he is, or what. But to be in his company for an hour and a half every Thursday evening for just a month and a half or so was just extraordinary. So invigorating, so reassuring. We encounter this sort of response all the time, all the time. So that is a longish answer to your question, I think, is it?
Yeah,
I hope I answered the question.
Oh, you did, absolutely. The whole idea, though, of you know what you're saying, and I think it would be very much backed up all over the place, is that the way the Leaving Cert is structured, the way the education system is structured, it takes from that element of the imagination,
the space
to allow your imagination. Mm. And it seems that there's no appreciation that even if you had it, for instance, within writing, merely having people to exercise their imagination, it could be used in so many different ways, even if there was no long-term future in writing for them.
Yeah, the thing about, you know, the notion you go into an exam, you have three hours to fill pages and pages and pages and pages, you can't change your mind. You're, as far as I know, I'm not sure if it's still the case, but if you put a red line through words and you change your mind, if it's mucky looking, you know, that's not creating a good impression. It's supposed to be that genius makes itself aware and spreads out across the page effortlessly. And it doesn't work that way. And really, sometimes a really good day's work, and we've all been in this experience, regardless of what we do for a living, changing your mind is often a really, really good day. And you might end up with stuff you've been working on in the bin, but you've started something that's way better, and you probably couldn't have got to that point if you hadn't worked through the other stuff first. Now, the Leaving Cert system does not want that, and yet it's a vital part of any creative endeavour. And there's a lot of goodwill. That's the great thing. There's a lot of goodwill within the Department of Education, within the teacher training colleges. That's why we've partnered now with DCU and what used to be it still is St. Pat's. And it's really, really great. It's great for us. I think it's great for them, I hope. It's great, hopefully, in the long term for children who'll be going through the education system. But it's just so stifling, the whole system. And the question we come up against again and again and again from parents as well, particularly middle-class parents, is how do you mark it? How do you mark it? And, you know, in isolation, the question is daft, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's not that there has to be some measure of success and excellence. There does and there do. But it's just, I could go on about it, but I think unique among the countries in the English-speaking world, certainly, is that come June, the Leaving Cert is normally the second item on the news.
Yep.
Whether Yeats came up on the Leaving Cert paper, it's paper two. So the first item might be Brexit, you know, last June. Second item is Yeats or Kavanaugh on the Leaving Cert.
Or Doyle.
I'm still alive.
Did you not feature one year?
I think there might have been something, yeah. But I didn't pay much attention to it. And then the third item might be, you know, the destruction of a nuclear power station somewhere. Or, you know, the unrest in Hong Kong, which is way more important than the Leaving Cert. But it's an industry, and it's utterly corrupt. And I don't mean to be critical of individuals when I say that. But, you know, going back, our country is still very young. Did our grandparents fight for the Leaving Cert? I don't think so.
No. The other thing that strikes me is that whole business of kids, and particularly kids who have any emotional difficulties from wherever they come from, that being able to access that creative side. Have you come across that where it's been very beneficial?
It's quite brilliant, and you know, surprisingly, in places you'd expect a group of kids from the North Side inner city school to come and start writing about social problems. Not necessarily, no. You'd expect, you know, we decided deliberately that we'd work with a group from a private school in somewhere near Dunleary, Christian Brothers School, but private, all boys, half dreading it because I didn't really fancy the idea of reading 24 stories about rugby, you know. One, no. 24, definitely not. And it was like, normally when I'm with a group of teenagers, I'm reminded of when I was a teacher. But with this all-boys group, I was reminded of when I was actually in school myself. And it wasn't a particularly welcome memory at all. But gradually, we got to know them a bit. And the stories they produced at the end of it was just quite amazing. 5 of the 24 stories were written from the point of view of women. you would not ever anticipate that when you saw these boys in grey, you know, in their uniforms walking in September. And yet five wrote from the point of view of women. They wrote all sorts of stories. So it's the same when you get kids from an inner city school. Their imaginations take off. Yes, some of them will write about dead father. We had a brilliant group of early school leavers, young women, four of them. There was a core of four of them. They came from the East Wall, and they wanted to write a story that had, you know, that they would use their own lives. And it was, you know, you had a granny with Alzheimer's. You had a father who was in Spain because he was wanted by the law. You had somebody, a sibling with drug problems. But in all this, there was the hilarity of their lives, you know. And one of them had a baby, and yet all of it was all about laughter, laughter. And it was just amazing. The kids, you got preconceived notions of what you might anticipate, and you don't. It's very often you don't get it.
One other thing, apart from your teaching background, Riley, when you yourself presumably were interested in reading in general as a teenager and that, and having a go at writing and that, and you know where you accessed outlets for your imagination in that regard. In fighting words, have you noticed with current young people, are they coming from a very different position? I'm thinking in particular of the whole screen culture, the whole culture whereby it would appear that there's a lack of attention spans or an issue because of the screen culture. Or do you see very little difference between what you see now and going back 30, 40 years or so?
Well, I'd almost deliberately say I don't see much difference. I mean, obviously you do. I mean, it's not just young people either. I'm sure there are several people in the room whose shoulders are close to breaking because they want to get their phones out and see if anybody sent them an email in the previous three quarters of an hour. I'm a bit like that myself at times. And, I think we see young people looking at screens and we assume they're wasting their time. And again, on Wednesday afternoons, we have a thing called, which we could just call Write Club. A lot of schools, as you know, have half day on Wednesdays. And these kids turn up and they just write. They have 3 hours and they just write. And there are no rules. Somebody goes around. I haven't gone in a while, but I'd sit and I'd chat to them and see what they were doing. If they were wanted, I'd read a page and tell them how brilliant it was. And there was one lad, a lot of them listened to music while they, you know, which in the world of literature, of course, is it. You can't do that, but, you know, you can.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so the rules. A lot of them have notebooks, you know, the Moleskine notebooks and then other notebooks that I would imagine are presents, and they use these notebooks. But there was one lad, it was a boy in this particular case, but since then I've seen women, or young women, girls doing it as well. And he was tapping away on his phone and he was listening to something. And I was about a yard, 2 yards away from him, and I could hear, you know, it was a full blast. He was, you know, and it was death metal or something he was playing. So I tapped him on the shoulder and I sat beside him and said, "What are you up to?" And again, if he was texting somebody, it's not a problem. It's none of my business. He said, "I'm writing a novel." And he'd written 52,000 words on his phone, which terrifies me because it'd be in my pocket and end up in the jacks or something, you know. And it terrified me, the whole idea of committing all that work. Oh. And he'd been at it for months to a phone. So, you know, I'm not necessarily saying for a minute that when you see your kid fluting around with his phone that he's actually writing an epic poem. But he may not be wasting or her time, you know. So it is interesting what's going on. As far as I can make out, young people still read books. The market for children and young teen books is huge. And if young people weren't reading them, it wouldn't be. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So in a way, it's business as usual. But obviously, times have changed. The way we watch television, the way we, you know, don't watch television, the way we consume television series, stories, I'm talking about stories. It doesn't really matter whether it's a book or a film or anything, you know, it's changed a lot. But essentially, the urge to tell a story hasn't changed at all.
Yeah. It would strike me as well that we read now, we were talking about, and of course you scripted your movie Rosie in terms of the homeless crisis. It would strike me as something if it was possible to organise for people who are in emergency accommodation, children in emergency accommodation in particular, yeah. Fantastic outlet.
Well, we had a group of volunteers, or some of our volunteers, out at a refugee camp in Jordan, working with Syrian refugees and training people who are actually living on the, you know, they just had an interpreter to interpret for them. And I recently saw a little film of what we do here in Dublin and elsewhere around the country being done in a refugee camp in Jordan. So yes, I don't know if we formally, we do so much, I'm the chairperson of the board and I can't really keep up with what we do because it's expanded so much. But whether we formally worked with children who are homeless, I don't know. But chances are, given that we have a primary school group every morning and a secondary school group every afternoon, we are working with homeless children.
Yeah, most likely. And the proliferation of, you're talking about 3,000 kids, most of them in Dublin alone, most likely. The other thing is, have any people who are children now, perhaps young adults, come back at any stage and said, do you realise what that course set me down the road doing? I mean, the positive way, quite obviously.
A life of poverty and destitution, yeah. Yeah, quite a few. At this stage, because we're open 10 or nearly 11 years, a growing number of our volunteers are people who came to us when they were school children. And we now have several published novelists who have been through us. We're not claiming responsibility for these people. They're responsible for themselves. But if we gave them a nudge along the way, great. What's particularly exciting from my point of view as a reader as much as a writer is, if you like, the extra grammar that has been brought into the English by, as an example, I'm thinking of a particularly brilliant young woman from Finglas who has Polish parents. And she wrote a story with us that she translated into Polish so her parents could read it. And her English, her writing was just absolutely brilliant. But in the same way, I think, because bubbling under our English, if you like, those of us who were born here in Ireland and have Irish parents, is the Irish grammar. You know, I'm after getting into trouble. I remember that was a text I got from one of my children. You know, he was in school. And at one level, I was thinking, oh, Christ, this is going to be a long day. And on the other hand, I was thinking, there's nowhere else in the world where he'd express himself this way, because it's a direct translation from Irish. But this young one and others, she's learning our English, so to speak, and hers. And bubbling underneath that is the Irish. And bubbling under that for her as well is the Polish. And it's happening with different languages. And it's just extraordinary what they're doing with the grammar, this hyphenated Irishness, which is brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I'm sure it's in music as well, I don't know.
And when you mention grammar, and again, this could be received wisdom that's often very wrong, but there's a perception that children today don't have a grasp of the essentials as previous kids did, purely again on the basis of the technological revolution.
I mean, about basic grammar.
Yeah.
Well, there are worrying signs. I mean, there are, you know, we're one of the things the Department of Education was kind of keen and we're working on it in St. Pat's is preschool, because kids are coming into school with basically less words. Yeah. And that's really, really worrying. You know, that's genuinely a cause for concern. Yeah, but grammar, what we do is we tell the kids to worry about grammar and spelling later, to free them up, because it is terrifying. People of a certain generation, myself anyway, who are, you know, your life really depended on your ability to put the comma in the right place. So the Christian brother behind you was going to hit you with a set square. So it can be very, it can be crippling, you know, for people who want to write. So there are those, there are some kids who won't go a step further without knowing exactly how to spell a word. There are others who are blissfully unaware that they've misspelled a word. And that's another day's work. We allow them to write. And then once they own the story, so to speak, once they it's their baby, then they start worrying about the grammar. I don't see much of a difference, really, when I look at the work of kids that I would see these days, to that which I looked at in 1992.
That's reassuring anyway, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's informal. It's not based on research other than my own and my prejudices, to be honest with you. But I don't see much of a difference there. But the really worrying thing I would have thought is the kids are coming into the first phase of their public lives, so to speak, with less words. That is very worrying, I would have thought.
Absolutely.
It means that they're not being spoken to as much as they used to be.
Which is a reflection on parenting. Mm. Yeah,
very extraordinary. I found it really a deeply moving statistic or a fact that I heard on the radio once. I can't remember who said it, but the biggest influence on a child is being read to.
Is being what, sorry?
Being read to.
Oh, yeah.
The biggest influence on a child, regardless of where they come from, is being read to every evening, particularly. And it's so simple, isn't it? And one would have thought, you know, I think a lot of us who have had children automatically think, ah, yeah, never have thought it was the most important influence.
Very true, yeah, yeah, mm. Definitely. Actually, talk of grammar reminds me of the famous quote from Con Hoolan, a man who misplaces an apostrophe is capable of anything.
Well, of course, I, you know, basically, if I hadn't broken the rules of English, I wouldn't be with you today.
Very good point.
I got a hammering from, you know, gobshites, I'll call them.
Yeah. But you said it out as it was spoken. That's what my challenge was, to
deliberately break the grammar and deliberately misspelled, because part of my wish as a storyteller was to try and capture the way people spoke in this particular part of the world. And it would be the same if I was deciding to write from English as spoken in Kerry or Belfast. I'd deliberately be breaking and twisting the grammar. But there is the point that you should know it first before you break it.
Yeah.
But, you know, lawyers will always, you know, I look at all these shops that decided to jettison the apostrophe, you know. Sometimes they just drop the S. So we're apparently Eason's. We're supposed to call it Eason. But luckily we never will. But lawyers will always need the apostrophe.
Oh, they will, yeah.
Yeah, because there could be huge difficulty if we...
I'd say, Roddy, you might find it a bit more difficult to get it as they talk it in Kerry, but that's for another day. We'd open it up there. Anybody have any questions they'd like to address towards Roddy? Well, Sean?
I know this isn't going to happen, Roddy, but if the government said to you in the morning, we'll give you a billion euro for kids, you decide how to spend it, what would you focus on?
I think I'd get rid of the leave and cert and work backwards. I'd immediately give whatever it's going to be at the end of the school a new name, and I'd work backwards. And I'd break down, probably saving money ultimately, I'd break down that relationship between grind schools and education. I would put a lot of money, I think, into sport. I would try to reverse, again, I'm not sure how accurate it was when I was listening to it on the radio, sports grants to clubs in Ireland, the highest were golf clubs and tennis clubs. I would not give a penny to golf clubs. I think it's outrageous. And the lowest was football and boxing. And I would put a lot of money into sports that are played by working class people. And I would try to, you know, we're talking about the redistribution of wealth, but it doesn't happen really. You know, social housing is a problem, no longer a challenge. If we got a map of Dublin and if we shaded in the areas that were, you know, council and corporation houses, it's a huge chunk of the city. And perfectly normal, wonderful people and their children came out of these houses since the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s and 70s. Now it would appear that putting these people in close proximity to each other is a huge social problem. We can't really have it. I remember when I was a teacher, I grew up in Kilbarrick, that way. And I was a teacher in Kilbarrick, and there was a newspaper, it might have been the Herald, I'm not sure, referred to the ghetto of Kilbarrick. And quite rightly, this is in the 80s, there was outrage. Now you hear the word being used to describe working class areas all the time, or we don't want to create a ghetto. I got in trouble, I live in Clontarf, and I said on the radio, I live in a ghetto, it's a middle class ghetto called Clontarf. But I don't hear anybody objecting to middle-class people living in close proximity. Some of my neighbours were deeply upset. You know, I couldn't give a shite, to be honest with you. You know, let them imagine what it's like for working-class people. Do you know what I mean? So I'm not sure the answer to me quite. The last person who should be given a billion to, you know, because I'd get other people to organise it myself, but I think I'd home in on education and sport, and I'd redistribute that wealth. I'd make sure that it goes straight to working class children.
On that issue of education, Roddy, continuous assessment, you know, you'll be aware that they're moving towards that. What do you think of that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. I do think, you know, an exam or a system that's based on learning by rote is so limiting and limited, and frankly, but learning by rote is not without its, you know, it does serve its purpose very often. We do need to learn stuff. You know, if I'm, if somebody's going to perform surgery on me, I'd really like to think that the surgeon knows step by step what he or she is supposed to be doing, and they don't, oh shit, we forgot number seven. Can we open them up again, please? You know, so there is a purpose for it. But I think continuous assessment is, I mean, the reality is, as a novelist or a writer, that's what I do all the time. The end result, if I'm lucky, is a novel or a play or a script or something. But it's constant assessment, constant changing my mind, constant working it, worrying it. And really, that's where creativity is, and often the rejection of ideas and stuff. And, you know, if you're going to have a system that's just the be-all and the end-all is the last couple of days of the 5 or 6 years that people are in school, you're not going to get that. You're not going to get that.
I know I'm jumping around here, but just one other thing that strikes me about fighting words. Have you noticed that it has inculcated in kids who come into the class a greater love of reading?
I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. That's I'll leave it at that, because that's the honest answer. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, no, it's just on the basis they do say, like, to be a writer, read. You know, anytime you see any of these, this advice, and just curious as to whether coming into touch with that element of things, whether it would.
I don't know. I don't know. We've had studies done, so that may be. I don't retain this information very, very well, but there may be proof. It may be there. Two people in DCU did a formal study of what we do, so there may be evidence. I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me. But whether you write first or read first, I mean, I came to writing because I loved reading, and I think that's probably the route that most writers would take. But it's not necessarily the only route.
No, not that. Yeah, we've somebody here, and somebody we and.
Thank you. Roddy, I'm very familiar with fighting words. I work with a junior cycle support service in Desh schools, and lots of our schools have brought groups out to fighting words all over and get great value from it. My question is, in terms of social justice and equity of access to all young people, particularly those who are coming from a disadvantaged background or those who are not supported through their families and so on, I would firmly believe, having worked in the area, that in terms of, I'm a librarian, and we have a school library service, but I think in terms of equity of access to arts and education, to creative writing, to access to reading materials, to encourage reading and so on, it has to come up through the school. Even in terms of going out to arts activities or going out to workshops like your own, the school has to make a decision who to bring. Can they afford the bus to bring them to it if they're not? If there's not one locally? So whatever way you look at it, it's limited to an extent. And there will always be kids who won't get the opportunity to avail of what's on offer. And I think in terms of, if we want to provide equity of access to all of our young people, to artistic and literary
activities. In the case of Fighting Words, as you probably know, everything we do is free.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
So
yes,
we've got...
Yes.
Throughout the country now, I think we have about 1,000 volunteers. Mm-hmm. And like the GAA or any football club or any sports endeavour at the weekends, if we didn't have the volunteers, we'd stop. We'd have to stop. Mm-hmm. We have a staff of 7 or 8, depending how you measure, and then about 1,000 volunteers.
Yeah. How do you fund?
It's partly private funding, but also some semi-state money, and then we get... grants from sometimes corporate, but a lot of generous people as well. But it's the constant challenge. I mean, it's one of the things that's on the, you know, on board meetings. Fundraising is always close to the top of the agenda. So it's been a challenge since we opened in 2009, which probably in terms some ways couldn't have been the worst, possibly the worst time to open, because the country was falling apart at the time. But that may be why we're still open, because a lot of people immediately started volunteering, I suppose, to express their citizenship or something in that way. I don't know if I'm answering your
Absolutely. I know, and I think you do wonderful work.
Thank you.
Should it depend on wonderful people like yourself and wonderful volunteers.
Well, it's not just
and so on,
the volunteers, 1,000 volunteers is a lot of people, you know.
Absolutely.
But I think myself, when I was listening to the report on sports clubs and the total inversion of the money, where it should be going and where it actually is going, somebody made the point that the money is there, but you have to apply for it. And that's true. But the people who have the money should be actively going and looking for the people who need the money. There are, apparently, there are lawyers who specialise in grant applications. There probably aren't many lawyers who bring their children to boxing clubs, you know. And probably they're bringing them to the GAA, which is brilliant. I'm not knocking it, ever. Or the rugby, and less to football. So that they, those two sports don't have the same access. So they're being robbed, basically, because they don't have that access. So the money is there. If the money is there, they should be actively going out and saying, this is how you apply. This is what, if you have it in by this time, we'll be able to give you the money, rather than sitting back and waiting, which is what seems to be happening.
Having looked into that area, Roddy, I have to say your analysis is absolutely spot on. I looked into it, and that whole area of applications and the specialisation of applications, and that's available in certain parts of the country among certain demographics, and it is not in others, no question about that. We're down here, and over here, we'll take the two of them together, if we could, yeah.
And I'm just thinking, some of the points that you made remind me of Patrick Pearce's early education school, which he established, Ard Scoileanna, and he was teaching there drama and nature education, which in effect was environmental education before it was ever heard of. And then in particular his book, The Murder Machine, which echoes very much the points you're making about the Leave and Serve system. Of course, it's a competitive system of education, which means that we're constantly segregating children and adults for higher purposes, and we're stratifying those for medicine, those for law. These are working class children, they won't be going anywhere. So we're effectively, structurally, have a system in place which is extremely oppressive, and that brings me to a mention of a second book by Pablo Freire, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is a study of the psychology of oppression, which I believe myself is that when the British left Ireland, the Irish people continued to oppress themselves with the British class system. We never got free of that. We had an opportunity in 1916. Unfortunately, all our revolutionaries were murdered, and we lost Joseph Plunk, the great revolutionaries of poetry and writing. And I think that has a profound effect on our state, and that's why we have an educational murder machine.
Off topic, somewhat a little more literary than policy. Apologies if people would prefer me to stick to the topics of the day. But, Roddy, something occurred to me earlier when you mentioned the 5 of 24 young fellas who decided to write from the woman's point of view. And I thought of your book, The Woman Who Walked Into Doors. And I'm not a woman, nor have I been in the situation you described, but I was convinced. And what I wanted to know is, where did you find that voice, or where did you learn to manage to write so well from the female perspective?
Well, thank you for saying that. But it was very, very slow. I had written a television series which the BBC made called Family, and the last episode centred on the woman Paula Spencer, a few months in her life. And I was very curious about her, so I decided I would see if I could write from her point of view. It took 2 years. It's a shortish novel. It took 2 years to write it. And I would say that most of what I wrote in the first year ended up in the bin because it was so vague, imprecise, nervous, tentative. I really didn't know what I was doing. But in that year, I gradually got to know her better. And I began to know where she came from. She was roughly the same age as myself, so I knew in some ways the soundtrack of her life. I knew the nightclub or the dance club she met her future husband in. The route they walked home together was the route I would have taken on a Saturday night. So gradually, you know, there are areas where there were always going to be foreign to me. Biology, for example, the violence, which I've never witnessed, let alone experienced. So that was very, very gradual. Putting down too many words is what I often do, and then taking a lot of them back. And gradually you get a precise picture then. It began to flow in the second year. Yeah, I wrote that novel in between 1993 and 95. So I like to think I'm giving you an honest answer, but it's a quarter of a century ago, isn't it? It is. Yes. So I'm not altogether, but that seemed, memory serves me, that's what happened. It's not, it normally would be the case when I start off something, it's quite imprecise, a bit vague, I don't know where it's going, I don't know what I'm going to do with it, and gradually then I get to know. It's a bit not unlike getting to know somebody, you know, except it's all about words and taking them away very, very often. So that's, and that's why in fighting words, we just get the kids to start filling pages as quickly as possible. Then let them judge it. But don't, you know, I've seen on, I saw a poster in a primary school about, you know, how to make a story. And the two words, this was a 10-year, these were 10-year-olds, conflict and resolution. Now, this wasn't a UN-sponsored program to, you know, to parachute little kids into war-torn areas to try and, you know, sort out the problems. This is about writing a story. I mean, who said the story has to be resolved for a start? You know, so you get to know the story as you go. You write as you go. So that's what I did with that particular book, and basically it's what I've done with everything I've ever done. But it was a harder one. It's the one I'm probably most pleased with because it was so difficult and so foreign to me. But thank you.
Anybody else? It was the lady here. Look at that mic.
You describe fighting words, and you do brilliant work. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Brilliant work. Fighting words belongs in the formal education system as much as it belongs on the edges.
Mm.
And a writer does, to do what you do, takes iteration, failure, fail again, fail better.
Mm-hmm.
And this 14 years in our education system in Ireland for young people leaves them, as you said, with 2-3 hours at the end to either fail or pass. Mm-hmm. And if they fail, they've no chance to reiterate. I would love to think that fighting words would fight to belong to the education system.
Yeah, that is the hope. But we also are mindful of the fact that one of the reasons why we exist is because we're outside the school gates and we want to stay outside there. But yeah, we like kids coming out of the school, seeing what we do and going back in. And teachers at this stage and, you know, educators are looking at what we do and going back in. I think if we as an organisation go into the schools, we will stop being what we are. I think, you know, there's a strange relationship between writers and artists and the society in which they are. We're kind of proud of them, but we bloody hate them as well. You know, they're cranky. They're the clowns, Shakespeare's clowns. We can get away with a lot. But what I always feel a bit embarrassed when artists decide that they are ambassadors for their country or that somehow they want that veneer of respectability. We should always be kind of outside the school gates. We should always be poking fun or, you know, throwing not bombs literally, but throwing verbal bombs. And that is our role in society. So I think I get what you say, and, you know, that's what we're at. But we have to get the balance right because most, I think you'd find as well, that an awful lot of the really great creative people become creative despite. I mean, one of the reasons the only thing I'd feel grateful to the Christian Brothers for is the anger. Because as Johnny Rotten said, anger is an energy. And I still feel it. You know, I still feel it. Whenever I feel, oh, I don't have the energy for this, I just think of that tick at the top of the classroom and writing me off and writing us all off. And that, at the age of 61, fuels me. No bother. So I think if we become too in, and all, you know, we could lose a bit. Does that make sense?
It does, but there is a balance in there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but we have to get there first before we can balance.
I think so. And have we anybody else? Yeah, just right down the back.
Roddy, you mentioned about the paucity of words, you know, that there weren't, people didn't have too many words, the younger people. I think we all learned words from our older generation, from conversation. And my question is that with so many of us, not only the younger generation, but the older generation too, on our screens so much, that we're not talking as much as we used to do. And I think, would you see that as a problem for the future? Because if we don't hear, if we don't talk, if we don't have conversations, then we're losing a lot of richness and a lot of the tradition that have come from previous generations.
We might be, but we're never going to go back to, you know, sitting around the coal fire or the turf and telling stories. It's gone. Never existed in my life anyway, so I wouldn't be missing it. The big worry is the lack of words, all right, and that would appear because there's less conversation. But, you know, we might calm down. On a trivial note, for example, when I moved into the house I live in 2004, you couldn't look out the door, but there was a van from Tesco's or another supermarket delivering. And to me, it looked like this was the end of supermarkets, so to speak. They'd be warehouses. But that calmed down, because I think people realise, one, first of all, practically speaking, you get, if you choose your own food, it's going to be better, frankly. But also that strolling around the supermarket may not be the worst thing you can possibly do for 20 minutes every couple of days. Do you know that the death of cinema never happened because people still like to convene and like to gasp and to laugh in the company of other people? I go to live football games quite a lot, and I'm in the company of thousands of people who are there with me for the exact same reason, because we're in company. We can bawl and shout and express our cheerful hatred at the opposition together. So, yeah, you know, the phones and are having a huge impact on us. They're probably part of our furniture, or part of an extension of our bodies at this stage. Darian Leader, the psychologist or psychiatrist, has a really nice little book called Hands. And he's very reassuring when you read it, because people, we all need to use our hands, constantly using our hands. I'm always at this bloody thing, on the beard all the time. The phone is another extension of that. You know, driver-free cars, I don't know if they'll have a future, because I think those, you know, personally, I like going through the gears. I'm not mad keen driving, but I actually like to drive when I'm driving. And I think a lot of people would be like that. It's your use in your hands. So I'm going away a bit from what I was, you know, what your point was. But I think we've kind of no right to expect people to live in a world that's gone. And we've created this new world. And it seems to me the first thing we start doing is criticizing younger people for living in it. Does that make sense? You didn't personally, but we hear it all the time. Ah, oh, they're brainless. They're like goldfish, 7-second memory. No, they're not. They're grand. But it is worrying that there's less words. You know, that's power. The only thing that we all own, regardless of whether we're, you know, from background, is we own our own language. That's the only thing. And if people could privatise it, like Liverpool attempted to privatise the word Liverpool, they attempted, you know, to own the word Liverpool. Luckily, they failed. But it would be privatised if at all possible. But we all own, and every child owns his or her own language, you know? But I suppose our job, if we like, if you know, those of us, is to make sure that that language is as rich and as varied and as geographically, shall we say, and societally respectful as possible. Slang is the richest form of language that exists, and people have been trying to stop it for millennia, possibly, and it doesn't work.
Roddy, thanks. We're just nearly out of time. One last question I'd just like to ask you, from your unique perspective outside the school gate and interaction with kids, and we've seen a lot today about projections into the future, some dire projections, lack of planning, whatever. Are you confident in the young people, the teenagers, the younger generation that we have coming through? Are you confident they're going to be able to cope with what at times appears to be massive challenges that are facing the world?
Yeah, there's nothing I've seen that tells me no, we're heading into a generation of mush. I hate the generalizations, the snowflakes, the millennia, you know, the millennia, the whatever. They're American imports. They're really, even when I was called a baby boomer once, and I asked, what does that mean? You're post-war. I said, we weren't in the war. Post-colonial, maybe. But, you know, I'm not American. I've even heard black Irish children being referred to African as African American. Do you know? African American Irish. They're hyphenated. That's where a lot of, as I said, the glorious creativity is going to come from, the hyphen, I think. Aside
from the children of immigrants.
Yeah. It may be there in music. I don't know. I don't want to be the bald man in the 60s at the back of a room watching a gang of rappers in the company of teenagers. I don't know. I have no evidence. But in the writing, definitely, that's what's coming down the pipe. I'll give you, you know, the analogy of football springs to mind, because I love football. The team I follow has been banned, Chelsea, the English team I follow, has been banned from buying footballers for a year. And they've had to rely on children, basically, from the academy. About half the team are younger than my own children. And so you got these 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, very, very young, very inexperienced, and it's the most joyous thing to watch since I was a child, watching Chelsea since 1970 when they won. I've never experienced quite the joy of just watching them now because of the youth and the brilliance and the arrogance of those players, you know? You would think, well, he must be African. He must be from some, you know, he must be East European. He must be. They're all English. Mm. They're hyphenated English. And if you look at the under 21 team in Ireland,
yeah,
it's hyphenated Irish, which is a brilliant thing. I hope, the hyphen is a great thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose one could suggest it isn't even needed at times. These people are just Irish and that's it.
No, but as a celebration. I mean, other bits of grammar are, you know, the apostrophe is disappearing without trace, so at least let's clutch the hyphen.
Okay.
As the water mounts up, and as you know, we're getting fewer and fewer places to live, we need the hyphen to hang on to, I think.
Roddy Doyle, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed our podcast. Check back here again soon for more interviews, as well as seminars and 10-minute lessons. Until next time, thank you for listening.